Hello and welcome to episode 57 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenu.
And this week, right before the release of the much-awaited Bollywood film Padman, we bring you a discussion on female reproductive health with Hollywood's very own gynecologist, Dr. Sherry Ross.
Dr. Sherry is a women's health expert and author of She-ology, the definitive guide to women's intimate health. Period. This book was named one of the 6 most life-changing wellness books of 2017 by Prevention.com and Women's Health magazine. She's the OBGYN of Hollywood, and stars like Reese Witherspoon, Jane Seymour, Brooke Shields, and Catherine McPhee are regular clients of Dr. Sherry herself. Padman will surely be a huge success, there's no doubt about that. But before we explore the narrative of using a pad, both Ankita and I believe that it's just as important to go all the way back to basics.
So if your parents didn't pass on this information to you, or if your school didn't emphasize on sex education, you have nothing to worry about, because we have Dr. Sherry, the gynecologist of Hollywood, to tell you everything you need to know about female reproductive health. So let's jump right into the show.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Sherry, and as a medical student who is particularly interested in gynecology, it truly is a great honor to have the OBGYN of Hollywood on our show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be talking to you, and even more excited that you're thinking about going into OBGYN.
Well, let's see if you convince me by the end of this.
I'll try.
So, Doctor, I first heard about your work on the Happier in Hollywood podcast, and I must say that I was quite uneducated at the time. So a lot of the things that you guys were discussing in that episode, those were truly, you know, like novel ideas to me. Uh-huh. So which this is one of the reasons why I thought that it would be a great opportunity to, you know, address our South Asian listeners too, because not only are we a little unaware about female reproductive health in general, but we're also shy to ask the right kind of questions, to seek help, and let go of a very strict, traditional, and often superstitious approach to all of this. So let me ask you our first question, which is that, you know, the very first time the question of female reproductive health becomes relevant in a woman's life is when she gets her period for the first time as a teenager.
That's right.
But most of the teenage girls in India, in fact, most of the single women in South Asian communities, they don't visit their OBGYNs because we go to our gynecologists only during or after a pregnancy. And there's a stigma attached to a visit for single women because, you know, it has another connotation, if you know what I'm talking about. So the first issue is to get information to young girls, and a lot of organizations like Menstrupedia magazine, they're trying to spread awareness. But even if these teenagers or these single women do visit their doctors, what should they be asking their doctors at that age?
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing up, really, we have the same problem to some extent. And I think it's really interesting just knowing what happens with women. And we're a product of our environment, our culture, our parents, our upbringing, and our religion. And I think that this is just what I'm trying to tackle in She-ology, is to create this dialogue where we don't feel shame, or we don't feel we can't ask questions, and really take just more of a stronghold on our health. So if you can't get it at home and it's time for you to go to your doctor, I mean, I think it's really important to ask the questions about your period and, you know, how to take care of your period, what you can do for it, what's common, what's not, and just start talking about personal hygiene, really your body in general. What age group are you referring to?
I'm referring to the early teens when they first get their periods, or when they're starting to become aware of physical changes in their bodies.
Yes.
So about 13, 14.
So, I mean, I would like to think that these teens, it's really, I mean, puberty really starts at 8 when you get your breast buds and pubic hair, 8, 9, 10. This is when I would like the conversation to really start. Because it's learning about your body and what's happening with it. And I would hope it would be explained by a parent, but if it's not, and it's the doctor who's going to be answering the question, is that who you're actually asking about, how it would be said with the physician?
The fact of the matter is that I never got the talk from my mom. And I actually knew about the period and the changes that were going to happen to my body at the age of 10 because my best friend's mother was a doctor and she gave her daughter the talk and my best friend gave it to me.
That's it. That's generally how it happens because I think that it's such a sensitive topic and it's not easy for our mothers to be the one to be having the conversation and to what you experience, this is not unusual. You're getting it from your best friend, maybe an older sister, an aunt. You know, it could be online, which you sort of hope it doesn't come from online. But I do think there are some good places to find out the information. But it's hard to know how to navigate it. So if you're going to your pediatrician, you know, there are questions you can ask just about your body and the changes and what to expect. But for someone that young, I think it's hard to know the words. I think it's harder for them to bring it up. I think it's more important to find a trusted friend or find, you know, a trusted adult that you can ask. But we like it to come from the parent. We like it to come from the mom. And that's what we're trying to educate moms to have those conversations about puberty and body and not just about your physical changes, but, you know, being respectful to your body. You know, that it's your body and no one else's and appropriate touching and body confidence and all these types of points are what we're hoping that happened with the mom or a trusted adult.
So Doctor, Ankita just mentioned what teenagers should ask when they're visiting their doctors. And you even said that children as young as 8 should be getting the knowledge about puberty and growing up. But how about women who are just in their 20s or 30s? You know, I believe that it's important for women to get regular checkups and to be fully aware of the importance of their reproductive health. So for anybody who's listening right now, maybe in India, who possibly isn't aware that it is possible to go to your gynecologist and get checkups.
If you're not married.
If you're not married and if you're not, even if you're not sexually active, what advice can you give to them? What can you encourage them to do more of?
Well, what I would hope that these young 20-year-olds would ask is just ask if what is happening with their body is normal. And if you're, you know, if your period, is it lasting? You know, how many days is it lasting? Is it less than 7 days? Or, you know, what's happening with feeling depressed or sad before your period? I mean, I think you have to explain what's happening with your own body and not be afraid, you know, not be afraid to say, you know, I haven't tried tampons yet. If I use tampons, does that mean I'm not a virgin anymore? You know, take away some of the myths, but ask just directly, because I know our heads are filled with myths about our body and what's happening, especially outside the United States. But I think these are the types of questions that are good to know and you know, what other changes you can expect with your breast size and, you know, are you wearing the right bra? Because you may know 80% of women don't wear the correct bra size. I mean, just some basic questions. Even wiping your vagina, you wiping front to back, you know, you're not introducing any bacteria into the vagina from the rectum. I mean, some of the basic hygiene questions of, you know, can I use soap on my vagina? Because we're told not to. But we want you to use, a female-friendly, non-fragrant soap on the vagina, the inside. You know, not deep inside, but the entrance to the vagina, the lips of the vagina. I would actually ask, and it may be you have to find comfort with this particular healthcare provider, but I like to pull out a mirror and say, let's look at the vagina together. That's often what the doctor may say, but I think there's nothing wrong for some young, curious, forward-thinking young woman to say, you know, can you explain to me my anatomy? Can you explain to me what's down in the vagina and what's normal and what's not? And do the lips of my vagina appear normal to you? Because everyone's asking these questions, you know, and I think if you're brave enough, I would really encourage you to have those hard conversations.
And even for slightly older women who visit their OBGYNs, opening up to them, it can still be an issue, whether we're talking about South Asian communities or even in Europe or the US. And in your book, Sheology, you talk about the importance of this communication and dialogue between patient and doctor. But how do you think this sort of communication and this sort of relationship can be encouraged even more in a community, more specifically like ours, which is a lot more closed and a lot more afraid to have these conversations?
You know, it's such a great question. And I, you know, I really think there's some responsibility on the woman to, you know, read as much as she can about her personal, you know, about normal body changes that are happening, you know, on reputable websites. And then you make a list of questions to ask the healthcare provider. And it can be, and I think things that are, you know, feminine hygiene is such an important topic because women have to get to know their vaginas very well. You cannot be afraid to, you know, want to know how to take care of it just from a cleanly sense standpoint, you know, sexual standpoint, you know, understanding, you know, your own sexual pleasure. And I'm a big proponent of masturbation so that you know what an orgasm feels like. So I think the questions to ask are really going to be dependent on and how this young woman is feeling about herself, because you can't always wait for the doctor to initiate these conversations. But I do think if you go to some of there's some very excellent websites for young women. HelloFlow is one of them. A lot of the, you know, I could probably shoot you some emails of some of the very helpful websites about women's health. You sort of need to know about your own body a little bit, at least what do you want to get out of that visit? You know, what's your goal? Mm-hmm. And if you have questions about, you know, your period, is it normal? How you feel when you get your period? You know, about, is my vagina normal looking? Because you have to realize that, you know, first of all, women, 65% of women, they don't even call it a vagina. They have code names, you know, for their vagina. So there has to be the ability to feel comfortable saying the word, number one. Half of women never talk about their vagina to anybody. Half of women, not even with their healthcare provider. So for a young woman to go into their doctor and start asking questions about their vagina and their vaginal health, that's a big deal. And I would encourage you to do that because it's going to take your generation and the generations to follow to own their vaginas and not feel ashamed that they can't talk about it, because they need to feel comfortable. We want you not to feel any shame or embarrassment when talking about it. But many young women, 1 of 5, don't think their vagina even looks normal. So I think there's some basic questions, and it can just be, you can say, you know, is my vagina normal? Can you just give me a tour? Can you tell me what's down there? Because I don't know. And I think that's okay. You know, because you need to know about your vagina. You need to know what's there. If you know, you need to know where the urine comes out. You need to know, you know, where the tampons are going in. You need to know where the clitoris is and the importance of it. Just some basic questions I think you can ask.
This is so interesting to me because I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but I'm going to tell you the story now. When I was 22 and I was doing my master's, one of my classmates actually didn't know that there was a separate hole down there for women that the period comes out of. So she thought that, you know, the urine and period comes out of the same hole. And so I asked her, how do you think a baby is born? And she literally believed that the baby was born from, you know, the rectum.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was just, and
it can be shocking.
Yeah.
But this is exactly the problem. I mean, women, you know, don't know their vagina at all.
Yeah. And women also don't put a lot of importance on, their sexual pleasure, because you were mentioning orgasm earlier, and you were mentioning how we need to put a lot of give a lot of importance to masturbating and experiencing an orgasm, because you have mentioned before how 10 to 12% of women have never had an orgasm.
No, it's so true.
Yeah, but that's because we live in a society where sexuality is frowned upon, and that's a big problem as well. Where we're taught as young girls that we're not really sexual beings, and we should only save our body for specifically for our husband or whatever. So that plays again, culture plays a big role in the whole conversation.
But doctor, can you actually talk about the bit where you say that the main erogenous zone for women is in the brain?
Yes, yes,
Or
yes.
is the brain?
Yes, that's right. Because if you think about it for women, our guide, our interest in sex and our excitement comes from how we feel about the person we're with. And that mental drive is so important. So our sexual stimulation is first going to be emotional for most women, then it becomes physical with stimulating the clitoris. But that's why the emphasis of the erogenous zone above the shoulders is so important. But I really believe that's true, and that's why we can't just take a blue pill, to get an erection and be able to have sex. We just don't work that way. So it's really important to understand that. If we don't like our partner for whatever reason, they're not being kind to us, or they're not giving us what we need, it's very hard to feel sexually aroused.
In all these years of experience, because just now we were just having a conversation about our culture and our society, but have you specifically in your career had to break through any cultural barrier or any superstition while treating patients?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's, again, these are, when I see young women and they're newly sexually active at 16, 17, because they're coming in for birth control, which I think is very important. But then I ask them, have you had an orgasm before? And they're like, no. And then we start the conversation about the importance of knowing your vagina, the importance of being comfortable touching yourself, finding out what is your pleasure areas and how to please yourself, because you cannot wait for your partner to be the one to give you your first orgasm. You just can't do that. So that's what I love about masturbation, and that's a barrier. That's a barrier. A lot of it's a roadblock for still even young women, of this generation. They still have a little bit of an awkwardness to touch themselves and to admit they're masturbating. But I think it's so important. So
You
this.
know, one of the biggest issues and struggles that we face in our community is imparting at least this information, putting this information out there, saying the word masturbation, telling people, talking to people about it. And this is a bigger problem, especially in the rural areas. So I was reading an article recently by a gynecologist who regularly visits a village in India every month. And this was quite eye-opening to me, because he mentioned how a couple approached him with a complaint that they couldn't get pregnant. And there was added stress from their families to produce an offspring. And they were, getting desperate by then. And the doctor conducted a couple of tests, and the tests revealed that they were both perfectly fine. They were fertile, but they couldn't conceive. So it took, a lot of strategic questioning on the part of the doctor to finally find out that the couple were having anal sex, and they were completely missing the target, so to speak. They didn't even know what they were supposed to do. So, you always emphasize on the importance of an open conversation between the doctors and the patients. And I really commend this doctor for even getting his patients to open up. But how can we bridge this kind of a gap in such communities? Like, if you had a South Asian patient who refused to talk about these things, how would you coax them into telling you what was going on?
And I think it's really true how to make changes in communities that really don't know they don't know what they're missing, and they don't even know the questions to ask. And I think it's, I think it involves, you know, a very special healthcare provider that can sit down and on a very simplistic and almost juvenile level, you know, talk about these issues. And I think it does take a lot of patience to literally have the conversation of, you know, where are you putting the penis, and do you know when you ovulate? And, you know, I think these are just hard conversations. I think you just have to really try to spend time, you know, learning a little bit about your own body. But it does, you know, it takes grassroots efforts to start the conversations and hope that people are given some incentive and have that flash, you know, sort of that light turn on moment where they're like, oh, well, maybe I'm not. But I think it is more challenging with someone who doesn't have the skills, the language, even the wording to know what to ask. I mean, I think it's a big challenge.
And since we're on the subject of fertility, doctor, I'm married, and especially because I'm married, I've had a lot of these young mothers corner me sometimes and say all kinds of absurd things like, if you don't give birth before you're 30, and in some cases I've even heard 25, they say that you won't have a healthy pregnancy. So please, can we address the age factor for modern women in relation to pregnancy? Till what age is it safe to not have a baby?
Well, you know, it's true. We're most fertile in our 20s. That's just certainly not realistic.
Ankita, you're running out of time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, so you know, it used to be that the complications of pregnancies happened over the age of 35. That's when you became an older, advanced maternal age woman. We know everyone's miscarriage rate is about 20% under the age of 35. Over 35, it becomes higher, becomes about 25%. As you get closer to 40, where we know you have a higher risk of genetic and chromosomal and medical complications, your miscarriage rate starts to get around 50%. So over the age of 40, 41, 42, 43, you have about 50, 60% chance of miscarriage. Over 44, it just gets much harder. So it's that 44 is the time where your chance of really conceiving on your own is going to be around 10%. So it's tough. It's tough.
And nowadays, it's not the end of the world if you don't give birth within a certain time frame, and we're being much more exposed to the idea of freezing our eggs. And I think that this is a concept a lot of women in India maybe are not fully aware of or fully educated about. So could you also please explain to our listeners what freezing your eggs is all about and why we do it?
I am a huge, huge fan of egg freezing. It's another way of family planning. Definitely, because, you know, again, what we want to do, and this is what I like to say, you know, taking family planning to a whole different level, because you're planning ahead. It gives women the opportunity to use their own genetics in the future. And the ideal time to freeze your eggs is really 32 to 37. That's when we're recommending women who aren't sure, you know, when they want to have a family. They may not have a partner. They're working. They're becoming an OBGYN in training, and they're very busy, right?
Yeah.
That was for you.
I know. I got the hint. I got the hint.
And the beauty of egg freezing is it's a short period of time where you basically go through the first half of an in vitro cycle. So your ovaries are sort of hyperstimulated, and then 10 to 20 eggs can be removed in one cycle. And they are put on ice, and then you can use them at any time, but your genetics are frozen also. So if you're freezing your eggs at age 32, Well, guess what? You can use them at age 40 and not have an increased risk of miscarriage because your genetics are also frozen in time. And we know that when you're much younger, the quality of eggs is much better, and there's much less of a chance of any chromosomal abnormalities. And anyone can get them reimplanted at any age. You could be 50. I wouldn't recommend it, but the point being is you could freeze your eggs and use them at a later time.
That's awesome.
You know, it's really cool here, and I don't know if it happens abroad, but, you know, Facebook and Apple, they actually pay women, they pay their employees to undergo egg freezing, and they give them the opportunity to delay motherhood.
Oh, wow.
That's interesting.
So they're really championing, you know, sort of these career-driven women by supporting them, you know, in the family planning department. And that's really a great health benefit. I will say the only downside is that it can be costly. So I don't know if that's
a good point.
Experience. You know, because it involves in vitro fertilization. And I know here in the United States, it can be, you know, $7,000 to $12,000 for one cycle.
Oh, so it's also possible to freeze your sperm like this, doctor. So is it as crucial as egg freezing, though?
Not so much. I mean, not so much, actually. They don't necessarily have to freeze their sperm. There are men who freeze their sperm if they've had testicular cancer. There's often they would go in before there's any kind of chemotherapy to freeze their sperm. But they don't have the same issues related to age-related, you know, infertility as women do.
And doctor, I want to repeat a question that was asked to you on the Happier in Hollywood podcast, because I feel like our listeners would definitely benefit from this information. So could you explain the difference between freezing eggs and freezing embryos?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, freezing embryos has been going on forever. And the quality of freezing a full embryo, so the egg and the sperm are put in a petri dish, and they create, you know, the cell divisions create the beginning of an embryo, if you will. And we can actually test that embryo to see how healthy it is too, and it can be frozen in time. But now, with the changes and the improvement of freezing eggs, we can just take an egg and freeze it, and know that when it defrosts, it's still going to be of high quality. And that's been something that has evolved over time. We had not perfected it, you know, over the last, you know, maybe a decade ago, but now it's a beautiful thing. So you don't need anybody else you can just use your own eggs and freeze them. And whether you want to wait for your partner or use a donor sperm, that egg will be ready to go when anytime you are.
And speaking of pregnancies, doctor, we know that a lot of women who think that, you know, the minute they're pregnant, they can sit back and not worry about what they eat and relax and not worry about the physical well-being as well. And somehow pregnancy seems to be considered to be more of a delicate condition than it really is. So can you tell us about the balance that is needed between rest, exercise, and eating healthy that is necessary during pregnancy? Because when I've spoken to some women in India, I've seen both ends of the spectrum, where people are saying, you know, that you shouldn't do any exercise, you shouldn't walk, you shouldn't go for long walks. But then I also
climb the stairs.
Yeah, see other people who say that, okay, you can do whatever you want, just relax, sit back. And obviously both extremes are as unhealthy as each other. So what is your point of view on this, on creating a balance over here?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we know, I mean, you know, when you get pregnant, I think your body definitely goes through a transition hormonally that is really challenging. And, you know, there are some basic things that you just have to know. I mean, for one, you need to eat 200 to 300 more calories a day, because you're creating this new being, and you need, you know, your total calorie count should be somewhere around 18 to 2100 calories to gain 25 to 35 pounds during the 9 months. You know, eating foods, you know, the fruits and vegetables and trying to get 40% of protein is something you really want to aspire to. And then protein can come from, you know, any source of meat, cheese, meat, poultry, and eggs. You do have to be careful about certain foods, such as raw, you know, fish, for example, you know, eating too much mercury, which we know is in certain foods, you know, such as shark, and I'm not sure what kinds of foods are popular, fish, but, you know, sea bass and halibut, they're higher in mercury, and so we do limit that. But also sleep is very important. A pregnant woman needs to get her rest and sleep at least 7 to 9 hours a night, because that, of course, is important, you know, for you to be able to function normally, think clearly, and allow the baby to really benefit from the increased blood flow when you're sleeping and laying in a, you know, sort of a restful position. I'm a big fan of exercise. We know that there's so many benefits of exercising 30 minutes a day, every day if you can, but it really helps some of the aches and pains, lower back pain, and you know, constipation and bloating and the swelling. It helps those types of things, but it also mentally and emotionally, it helps with your energy and your mood and sort of your, you know, your posture, and it even allows you to sleep better. But interestingly, there's been studies to show that babies are even have higher IQs for moms that are exercising. So there's benefit all the way around for exercising pregnancy. Very, very important. So I'm a big believer in it.
And also, I mean, not just in pregnancy, we also see this problem. I don't know what it was like for Ankita, but when I was growing up, I've always been a big fan of exercising and sports. But I do remember that when I was on my period as a teenager, and I would go out to play basketball or football or whatever, my mom would say that I shouldn't be doing exercise whilst I'm on my period. And I don't know what it's like in the US, but in India, it's a very big misconception that you shouldn't exercise whilst you're on your period. And
you shouldn't do a lot of things while you're on your period, yeah, including pray in the temple and things like that. But yeah, the exercise.
Yeah. And I still believe that exercising really helps me mentally and physically as well. So what is the science behind this? I mean, I think it's really important to tell our listeners that there is a connection between physical exercise and actually feeling better when you're menstruating.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the myths come from if you're bleeding a lot, you're becoming more depleted of volume, you know, and that is not a good time to be working out. So I think it depends. I mean, the average period is 4 days. You know, it's not like you bleed 80 milliliters, you know, 80 milliliters of fluid is not that much blood. But if you do have large blood clots and you're bleeding more than 7 days, then I do think there's something to be said about not overdoing it. And maybe praying in the temple may be good. I won't discount that. But you know, the uterus is a muscle. You know, it's one big muscle. It's the size of a pear. And when you're bleeding a lot or you're just having your period, it's contracting. And that contracting motion is what causes the cramps and causes the pain. So, you know, that can be really debilitating for women. And that is why, you know, we suggest some remedies that are helpful to relax the uterus, you know, like taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, ibuprofen. It helps relax the uterus and it also blocks, you know, the sensation of pain that's brought on by the period. But, you know, exercise is kind of a simple way to relieve cramps because we know it's the feel-good endorphins are being produced, right? So you're exercising, the endorphins are being produced, and that helps, you know, build tolerance to pain and kind of reduces the stress and discomfort of cramps.
Yeah, because I think you mentioned a very crucial point, and that is that the reason we have cramps is because our uterus is contracting. I remember my mom trying to explain this to me, and it's quite funny now that I think about it, because I'm pretty sure she still doesn't know why we have cramps, but she made up so many excuses to explain why we have cramps. So anyway, that now we know why we have these cramps.
So earlier we touched upon hygiene with you, Dr. Sherry, and I just want to discuss that in a little bit of detail, because we released an episode on the subject of female genital and reproductive hygiene a while ago, and a bunch of South Asian doctors actually came up to us and said that we shouldn't be encouraging young women to use vaginal soap. And they said that water and someone even said that all that's needed is warm water and salt to clean the area. But you clearly hold the opposite view. So could you explain how you feel about this?
I think the misconception is that, you know, the vagina has sort of an inside canal, and it has the outer labia, and, you know, a healthy vagina, I mean, you need to give it the same hygienic attention as any other part of your body, just like your face. The tissue there is as sensitive as your face. So between the urine and the sweat and being so close to the anus, I mean, salt and water is not going to do the job. Okay, let's just be real. You know, you need to prevent the buildup of bacteria, and which can lead to pimple and acne and odors that are in the vagina that just can happen throughout the day. So definitely the outside of the vagina where the labia are, you can, you know, clean it I do agree it has to be sort of a vagina friendly, you know, intimate wash. And we have a couple out here that work well, Vagisil and Summer's Eve, they have intimate washes that are specifically for the vagina. And, you know, and it doesn't disrupt the pH balance, because the vagina is all about balance. I mean, it's, you know, inside the vagina. So that's the outer area that you absolutely have to clean with soap and water. And there's no increased risk of any infections if you're, you know, cleaning the outside and the entrance to the vagina. Inside, if you part the lips a little bit, you can clean that area. And I even take, you know, a finger, the first two knuckles, so that length, into the vagina, and I clean the entrance right into the inner canal area with soap as well. I think that the...
So that's safe, you're saying?
That's safe. I've never had a yeast infection. I'm 55, so I believe that you have to clean that area.
And we're completely on board with this as well. But when people talk about, listen, our grandmothers never had to go through any kind of infections. They never used any soap in the area, and it's not safe. And someone even said that it's only now that you hear about fibroids and all these problems with the uterus. People back in the day didn't have it. And I'm just thinking, people back in the day probably had it, and they were not properly diagnosed with these things because there was no technology available at the time. It's just this massive fallacy, and people just don't get it.
Right. And then, you know, and I think, too, that the confusion is to this douching. You know, douching is where there's, I think, more confusion, because back in the day, you know, our grandmothers and their grandmothers, they were using these pre-made, you know, cleaning mixtures, and they put them in a bottle with a long little tube, and they put it into the vagina. They'd squirt it way up there. And this internal cleaning is really what's not recommended, because, you know, if you do that, if you douche and you are putting chemicals into the vagina, you are really removing the healthy bacteria, and the healthy pH balance is being disrupted, and this is how you get a yeast or bacterial infection. So I think that we really have to break it down. Like, what areas are you actually talking about? But I think as a rule, people just have said, oh, no cleaning the vagina, and I think it's really wrong information. You know, but this is the difference.
And you're speaking of UTIs or urinary tract infections, which are quite common in young women. So I think that a lot of girls, I mean, just a couple of months back, a close relative of mine called me and she said, you know, I think I have an infection, but I don't know what to do because I'm too scared to go to the doctor because, you know, of the embarrassment that they feel. And she wasn't too sure if it was an infection. So can you just briefly explain what are the common symptoms that a young woman would have if they have a yeast infection or a urinary tract infection?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that the other problem is, you know, when I get a call from a patient who has a bladder infection or a urinary tract infection, it is often caused by having sex. So this is where maybe culturally, you know, we sort of have a little hint of this. It doesn't necessarily mean that. But, you know, if you're under, you know, a young woman, well, even if an older woman gets, you know, UTIs, I mean, 60% of women will have had a UTI once in their lifetime. So, you know, if you are feeling pain with urination or sort of this urge to urinate frequently and only a little bit comes out, or if you have pressure or fullness in the pubic area, you know, it's kind of classic for a UTI, especially if the urine has any color, you know, color changes, if it's red or pink or has an odor to it, it's probably a urinary tract infection and you need to get treated with an antibiotic. I mean, I can, you know, give you suggestions to prevent them, but it can be very serious.
Yeah, so antibiotic therapy is needed and they should go to a doctor.
Absolutely. I mean,
exactly.
It's very important because if it doesn't get treated and if it's a true urinary tract infection caused by E. coli, which is, you know, the most common organisms that we find in the urine, it can get into your kidneys and it can cause a very serious kidney infection. And that's, you know, involves fever and chills and back pain. And it's very serious. So if you have any changes of the urine, of your urinary habit, you have to go to your doctor.
And you mentioned douching earlier, and you mentioned how, you know, you're not the biggest fan of vaginal douching, and you in fact think that it's not helping women in any way. But there's also this new trend out there with vaginal steaming. Uh-huh. And a lot of, I'm 100% sure that a lot of women listening right now from our communities, they don't even know what vaginal steaming is all about. So can you explain what it is? And do you think it's necessary for women to try it out?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of trends that happen here in the United States, and in part, you know, we get the likes of...
In Hollywood.
Yeah. We get Gwyneth Paltrow, and we get, you know, well-exposed women boasting about these beauty treatments. And I mean, look, the Mayan women, traditional healers, you know, did vaginal steaming long before Gwyneth Paltrow did it. You know, using mugwort and wormwood sprayed at the vagina. I mean, I think the research doesn't support the claims of it, you know, curing your periods or curing a bladder infection or curing fibroids or infertility. There's no medical research to prove that it does this. I think if you're steaming the outside, it's probably okay to do it, but you know, soap and water may just do the same thing. I mean, my main concern with steaming is that it could have a similar effect to douching, where it's cleaning out sort of the good bacteria of the vagina. And that could disrupt the pH balance and it can cause a yeast or bacterial infection, similar to douching.
It scares me a little bit when I think about it, you know, when I picture it, I think, what if something goes wrong and it, you know, it's steam at the end of the day? And I don't know, it might be a very psychological thing, but I cringe when I think about vaginal steaming. And that's why I wanted to ask you, is it something we should be trying out? Is it safe?
You know, I think it's a fad. I don't think it's necessary. I think it could cause more harm than good, to be quite honest. I mean, is the goal, my favorite thing to do for the vagina is get into warm water in a bath, take a handful of extra virgin coconut oil. It's really, really good for the skin of the vagina. It's good for, you know, you could do anything you want with extra virgin coconut oil. You can even drink it. You know, it's very good for your body. There's no additives, there's no fragrance. But it rehydrates. So if steaming is meant to hydrate and clean. I think extra virgin coconut oil in a warm bath is going to really give you, you know, a similar result without increasing your risk for a yeast or bacterial infection.
And, you know, we're speaking about hygiene in genital area. And as a doctor, what is your take on the importance of hair removal? Because, again, you know, we're talking about especially our community in India and the South Asian community. Nowadays, girls are much more aware of this. But back in the day, I mean, when my mother was young, when previous generations, they don't see any importance to this. So how important is this for maintaining your hygiene?
Well, I think it's really, you know, what you do with the hair is it's your personal preference. I mean, you know, I think we believe women, you know, it's not like getting a mani-pedi or tweezing your eyebrows. I think when you're removing the hair from the vagina, you know, maybe you think it looks more sexy, maybe you're partner is asking you to remove it too. I mean, I think we're looking at porn stars. We're our visual and the messaging that we see is to take it off is cleaner, is healthier, is sexually better. You know, maybe you can find the clitoris easier, which probably is true, you know, on some level, but it's all a personal preference. I mean, I think it's, you know, some women just like to groom the pubic hair. They think it looks more clean and tidy. I mean, it's hair does not mean it's not clean and tidy, but it's, I think it's just, it's a look. And it's also
because there are just two extremes when it comes to this. People who believe that you shouldn't touch the pubic area, you just have to leave it alone and let it be what it is. And there are people who say that if you don't consistently remove hair, then it's completely unhygienic and you should be doing it. So is there a middle ground? Is there a hygiene element to this? That's what we were wondering.
Yeah, no, I think there's no hygiene element. I mean, if you've never cut your pubic hair and you're taking showers every day and you're using soap on the vagina, it's going to be fine. It's going to be clean enough. Mm. It's, you know, usually before you have sex, you know, depending what your sexual practices is, I mean, you should, even if you can, you know, if you can't always shower, but you can bring little, you know, wipes. There's feminine hygiene wipes that you can use to clean the vagina. You always want to wash your hands, and you hope your partner washes their hands as well. You know, because that you're going to be more apt to have infections if that is not happening.
Sorry. It's just, you know, coming to the more psychological side of things now. So postpartum depression is something that is getting increasingly talked about, even in our South Asian communities. People are acknowledging it, but there's still such a stigma attached to it, you know, and a lot of women don't want to even admit that they're suffering from it, because ours is a community where sometimes accident victims and trauma victims themselves, they refuse to go through psychological or psychiatric help because they would never want to be branded as a crazy person, and then no one would marry them because they had to go through psychiatric treatment. And it's the same with being branded a bad mother or a bad homemaker, and then someone else would have to intervene. So, you know, can you just talk about how common it is, postpartum depression, and what causes it, and, you know, how it can be normalized in our society?
You know, I like to call postpartum period the fourth trimester, because, you know, it's very
that's a good way, yeah,
you know, it's very physically and emotionally challenging as a result of, you know, hormonal havoc that's taking place. You know, 80% of women will get the baby blues. It happens 2 to 3 days after you deliver, and it, you know, you feel anxious and depressed, and you're frustrated, and you may feel teary-eyed, and you may cry a little bit for no reason. You're not sleeping well because you're just, you know, you're transitioning in the most significant way. And the baby blues last, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. By 2 weeks, you should be, you know, it should be resolved and feeling better. Now, about 10 to 15% of women, you know, go on to have postpartum depression. And it's very common. Unfortunately, it just is. And we see it, especially in women, you know, who have a history of depression. Well, there's such a significant women that experience depression that, you know, I'm surprised that 10 to 15% is not higher. So if you're feeling after 2 weeks, you're feeling more mood swings and irritability and panic attacks and overwhelming sadness, and that you just can't maybe even care for the baby. I mean, this is common, and there's treatment for it. And, you know, it's completely understandable why it's happening, and you should not feel like a leper if you have it.
Mm. So, doctor, I personally, when I get my period or when I'm about to get my period, I don't usually suffer from the usual, symptoms like bloating. Or...
Yeah, she turns into a monster. That's what happens to her.
I don't get period pains, no stomach cramps, nothing, no bloating, but I get extreme mood swings. And I also just get, the second symptom is my left breast becomes a little more tender. So I know my period is coming, but my biggest indicator is when I get this horrible mood swing and I'm, really emotional at that time. So are women like me more prone to postpartum depression?
Yes, yes, you may be more prone to it. I mean, we tend to see it, you know, women who have a history of depression, or women who maybe it was an unplanned pregnancy, or anyone that maybe their partner, you know, is not that helpful, or there's issues, you know, related to their marriage, or, you know, I think these can put you at risk. I mean, if you have some PMS and it's not horrible, you know, you probably will be okay. But, you know, I think it's important that, you know, to see what's happening with your anxiety.
You know, it's a bit like clockwork, and it's even 9 days in advance. Most of the time I track it and I see that it's 9 days in advance. If I have a really bad day for no reason and I go and look at my calendar, I know that this is probably PMS, which is why I'm so touchy and emotional and angry and irritable all at the same time.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think it's good to recognize that. I mean, you could do a lot of lifestyle changes. You know, if you want to avoid certain foods that are making you bloated or gassy or high sodium that are going to make you feel, you know, more, you know, weight gain and swelling. And, you know, you can do different, you want to exercise more, you want to take calcium. There are things you can do that may help lifestyle wise. Mm.
Yeah, Ankita, can you please figure what that is so you don't turn into a monster every month? But along the lines of periods, many women, obviously, they suffer from very painful periods, and women suffer from what we call dysmenorrhea. And this is only something that I studied more about in my gynecology studies, and it's never been spoken about in our community. And I feel that many women probably do have it, but they're not aware of it. So in the most simplest way possible, how would you explain dysmenorrhea, and how can this be diagnosed, and how do we treat this condition?
Yeah. So dysmenorrhea, I mean, we spoke about cramps and, you know, cramps that are tolerable. We don't put into the dysmenorrhea, but cramps that are debilitating and affect our daily routine or disruptive, we then call that dysmenorrhea. So it's really significant, horrible, bad cramps that do affect your lifestyle. And that's how we differentiate it from just the common ones. And listen, I mean, we want to make sure, you know, that you don't have any other underlying problem like endometriosis, or, you know, even if you have thyroid disease or there's something else going on. But, you know, most of the time there's no real cause other than just you're having really bad cramps. And we can treat that. We can help you with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. When you first feel your period coming on, you can start taking Motrin or Advil. The birth control pill works really well to lighten your flow. Exercising regularly, as we talked about, and even healthy lifestyle, you know, drinking more water helps relax the uterus, taking calcium and, you know, eating foods that are calcium rich also helps. So there are even fish oil, you know, they think can help block the prostaglandins and the pain that you experience from the inflammation from the cramps.
And I mean, I was just generally talking about the South Asian community and how we're not so aware of this, but I'm just curious to know that do many women in Hollywood have this disorder, and do you think it receives enough attention?
I think it's women in general do experience bad cramps. I don't know the exact statistic, but I would say 25% of women have significant cramps where they need to do something. And that could just be Advil, you know, or Motrin, or I will put women on the birth control pill just for their cramps. So it does happen quite a bit. And again, it's the conversation. It's changing the narrative. It's talking about our bodies, talking about our wellness. I mean, cramps are so basic and women need to talk about it. We need to change this dialogue. And this is my whole vagina revolution is it's a metaphor actually to talk about our health. So if you have it and you're living in one of your local towns where you all are, I think you need to talk to your doctor about it.
And doctor, I've spoken to a few of my friends back home in India regarding the HPV vaccine, and everyone sort of has this misconception that this is only needed before you get married. And, you know, a lot of people don't understand that STDs can be transmitted without someone being married, and only sexually active women need to.
HPV here, I mean, 80% of men and women carry this, is the most common sexually transmitted infection that men and women have. And it's spread person to person through sexual contact. You know, during vaginal, anal, or oral sex, it can be passed. Condoms, of course, we always talk about the importance of safe sex and wearing condoms. Unfortunately, it doesn't always prevent the transfer of the virus. I'm a huge fan of young women and men getting the HPV virus. I mean, HPV vaccine. It's very important to get it. Very important to get it. You know, we recommend young girls getting it, you know, 11 to 12. So what's the practice over there?
In Gibraltar, actually, it's very similar, doctor. And it only started to get introduced when I was in school. So I would say about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, they started to introduce it. But I don't think it's like that in India, right, Ankita? Because in our schools, we had a system. So I don't know.
Yeah, but mostly in India, we have private hospitals and private healthcare. And you're not really... And another thing is that not a lot of young girls go to their gynecologists and doctors that often. So it's something that just gets swept under the rug most often. Uh-huh. And people just think that, right before you get married, maybe you need to go and get it because now you're going to be sexually active. So, you know, God knows what's going to happen. But there's this huge misconception about it. Yes.
And do you think that efforts are being made now to introduce this, to educate people about this in South Asian communities and other parts of the world?
You know, I think I would suspect it's happening because this virus is epidemic. And it's actually the conversation would really be with your pediatrician, because young girls ages 11 to 12, that's about the age that they should get it. And then the male should get it before 21. So again, it's the conversation that just has to take place, that it's important, especially HPV, because it's connection to cervical cancer. And it's directly related to that. And getting the Gardasil, the vaccine, can prevent 90% of the HPV types of viruses that lead to this problem. So it's really amazing what it can do. So, you know, it's important, and I imagine countries outside the U.S. are lagging behind, but it's a very important conversation to have.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Sherry. We're so grateful that we had the opportunity to pick your brain today and speak about
Anytime.
A lot of things that I think are very important to the women in our community. So if any of our listeners do want to get in touch with you, how can they go about that?
Yeah, I mean, drsherry.com is my website. I'm also on Instagram, Dr. Sherry R. On my website, I have a lot of articles talking about these very sensitive topics. I can even be reached by email. You know, I do phone consults all the time. I mean, maybe get a list of questions from your listeners, and we can hone in on some of the other topics that they are curious about.
That would be great.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. I would love to have a part two with you with listener questions. That would be amazing.
Anytime.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it. It's been fun.
Thank you so much, Doctor. Thank you so much for your time today.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks for thinking of me.
And as always, we're very grateful to all our listeners for tuning in each week. We hope that this conversation with Dr. Sherry not only helped you understand some basics of female reproductive health, but also gave you an insight into everything new there is to know about modern medicine and the specific side of medicine.
Remember, ladies, there's nothing to be shy about when it comes to your body and your vagina. If you have any questions, do drop us a mail and we'll be more than happy to do a second interview with Dr. Sherry where we discuss your questions and she gives the answers herself. You can get in touch with Dr. Sherry on her website, drsherry.com, and you can also find us on social media at The Desi Outsiders. Please do send in your thoughts, feedback, and comments to mail@desioutsiders.com, and we promise that we read each and every one of your emails, and we also try our best to respond to them as well. So until next week, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Insiders.